Thank you.
Side.
Just push it until it turns green.
No, it's not that you're in the way. It has to do with
you. Oh, I got you.
Good evening.
You won't be in the way.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to tonight's edition of the Dallas Philosophers Forum Lecture Series. I'm David Drum. I'm one of the people serving on the board of directors for this organization. Let me ask first of all, how many people were here for your first Dallas Philosophers Forum Lecture? Okay, great. Appreciate that. How did you hear about the lectures?
I just typed in Dallas Philosophy and it popped up, yeah.
Good. Okay. We hear that a lot and we're glad you found us. We're a relatively unique institution in that we've been doing more or less the same program for 30 years and running, and we are all volunteer, nonprofit, and no paid staff. We take up a contribution at the door to kind of cover our publishing expenses and equipment expenses and so forth. And we espouse no particular worldview. Our mission is to expose the interested public in this area to kind of all sorts of viewpoints so that they can understand and be exposed to them and not necessarily, you know, kind of cram one viewpoint down anybody's throats. And we encourage everybody to order from L. Phoenix because we get the room free. They kind of expect a certain amount of revenue. It's okay if you don't eat, but we encourage you to eat, and we encourage you to tip your wait staff generously. And if you didn't get a chance to contribute on the way in, Rob, who's our president, has temporarily taken over the treasurer duties. And we ask for $5 for the lecture. And if you want to be a regular, $35 will get you 6 months or 12 lectures. So quite a bargain. So check our schedule for future topics. We try to be as varied as we can and cover the waterfront, both the technical philosophical topics and those of more general interest. And tonight, we're delighted to welcome one of the faculty from Southern Methodist University's philosophy department, Professor Jennifer Mady. And she has been here in Texas for a little less than 2 years. And so relatively new to the SMU faculty. Before teaching at SMU, she was at the University of Miami in Florida. And she did her PhD work at SUNY Stony Brook in New York. And her primary interests include ethics. And of course, tonight we have kind of an interesting application of ethics, which is, you know, how do ethics pertain to deception in the context of a social or romantic relationship. So, sounds like a pretty interesting topic, so let's welcome Professor Jennifer Mady.
That's how old I am.
Can you hear me? No.
See if you can move it up a little bit higher.
Turn on the hearing aids.
Is that better? Is that better?
Keep going.
Louder.
Hello? Okay, thank you for inviting me. I'm excited to talk about this new project that I started this year. And this will be the first time that I'm talking about it in public, so I'm excited to do that. And it's on consent and the role of deception in consenting to sexual relationships. So significant strides have been made in recent years in addressing and understanding the nature of sexual misconduct. For instance, in the public realm, a lot of awareness has been brought to the problem of prevention of rape on college campuses. And campaigns like It's On Us focus on the importance of unambiguous consent to sexual relationships. This increase in public awareness of sexual misconduct has coincided with a deeper theoretical understanding of the nature of at least some forms of sexual misconduct. Rape is one example, whereas rape was once thought to refer just to unwanted sexual acts perpetrated on a victim through the use of physical force. In 2012, the FBI changed the official definition of rape to prevention, no matter how slight, by a sex organ of another person without the consent of the victim. Moreover, it's recognized that a victim's expression of consent can be nullified by cognitive impairment or incompetence, coercion, and sometimes by deception. This talk concerns the impact of deception on consent and makes a proposal about what the consequences of that impact are for our moral obligation to honesty in sexual relationships. I'll start with some basic assumptions that I will not argue for. One of these assumptions is that in general, we owe it to each other to not cause unnecessary harm. By unnecessary harm, I mean harm that isn't the consequence of our doing something that we should be doing, like performing our moral obligation, or perhaps protecting another right, or bringing about a greater good, or even doing something that is within our rights. So if and when some action, such as deception to a sexual partner, causes unnecessary harm to them, then we ought not to do it. Interfering with consent causes harm. So if deception interferes with consent, then one of the wrong-making properties of deception to a sexual partner is that lying to them can interfere with their ability to consent to have sex with you. I'm allowing here that deceiving your sexual partner could also be wrong for other reasons. In the paper, however, when I talk about deception being morally permissible or impermissible, I mean strictly in virtue of its relation to consent. Other than the focus on which deceptions to a sexual partner should be prosecutable as rape, and the general issue of whether deception can undermine consent, not too much more has been written on the specific relationship between deception and sexual consent, nor on the moral rather than legal imperatives that might follow. As I noted, current rape by fraud law expresses the recognition that at least some cases of deception undermine or invalidate consent. For example, in Arizona, California, and New Jersey, deception about the nature of the sexual act that's taking place counts as rape. In Texas and Tennessee, you cannot lie about your identity or aspects of it. And in some states, such as Virginia and Utah, intercourse that is induced by deception can be prosecuted as sexual assault. Based on the rape by fraud model, it looks like we might be culpable when we lie to sexual partners specifically in order to get them to consent. This idea has two parts. The first part I'll call the intention. This is the condition that we should not deceive with the intent to get consent. The second part I'll call the counterfactual notion of consent, where consent is undermined by some deception when we lie about something that is relevant to consent in the counterfactual sense, such that, had we not lied about it, our partner would not have consented. I take these two notions to be implied in the idea that it counts as assault if the intercourse was, quote, induced by deception. While I agree that lying to a sexual partner in order to get them to consent where they otherwise might not have is clearly wrong and undermines consent, I don't think that either of these two conditions that I just outlined need to be met in order for deception to be morally impermissible. I'm going to discuss some problems with taking each of these things to be necessary wrong-making features, and then I'll outline a different way of thinking about consent. I'll show the way that deception impacts consent on that model, and then draw some general conclusions about moral obligations concerning honesty that I think follow. But first, I want to talk a bit more about the concept of consent and why getting consent is morally significant. So our bodies are not merely our property. They're the means through which we engage with the world and the site of our thoughts, hopes, fears, and desires. They are, I would contend, a part and parcel of who we are. We don't just control their actions, but we also control the access that others have to them. It's commonly understood that there is a prima facie boundary that prevents others from having access to or use of our bodies. The act of giving consent to access our bodies removes this boundary. But consent derives its moral force only when it is an expression of our autonomy. In the most basic sense, to do something autonomously just means to do it voluntarily or freely out of one's own authentic desire. Being autonomous also gives us the ability to decide for ourselves how we want to live, to set our own goals, to adopt values and principles, and to reason about our behavior and live in accordance with these self-chosen ends. These abilities lead to greater well-being, and so autonomy is taken to be central to living a flourishing human life. Sexual autonomy in particular refers to this power as it is manifest in our sexual lives. We have a basic right to our bodily integrity. It follows that we have a right to freely decide when we want to engage or refrain from having a sexual relationship. And this includes the positive right to pursue types of sexual relationships that we do desire, and the negative right to refrain from types of sexual relationships that we don't want. For example, we have a right to refrain from having sex in circumstances that we don't want, and to not have sex with particular persons that we don't want to have sex with. We even have a right not to have sex with persons that have specific attributes that we don't like. Again, oftentimes, these preferences are expressions of values and goals that promote our well-being and flourishing. But the moral significance of our voluntary choices need not be grounded in the fact that such choices can promote general well-being or specific aims and goals. Our sexuality is considered to be an important part of our self-identity. Freedom to self-determination in this realm on its own and the maintenance of control over our bodies and selves from others is itself morally significant. The notion of consent derives its moral force from the assumption that consent is an expression of our autonomy. So interfering with someone's autonomy can impact and even invalidate their consent. The moral prohibition against interfering with a person's sexual autonomy is grounded in the fact that violations to sexual autonomy cause harm. I'm allowing here a broad conception of harm that grants that even in cases where there is no subjective experience or negative practical consequence, an action can still harm a person. I think that there are at least three ways that interfering with a person's sexual autonomy harms individuals. First, there are possible practical harms. As autonomous people, we often make choices that are consistent with our interest in our own physical, material, emotional, and psychological well-being, and which promote our goals and values. Losing control over the boundary that prevents others from having access to our bodies leaves us vulnerable to various risks. One example of such a risk involves outcomes that are inconsistent with our reproductive goals and our sexual health. Say Jane has an interest in not catching a sexually transmitted infection, and she decides that monogamous relationships are the least risky. If Ed interferes with Jane's ability to control this aspect of her sexual relationships by pretending to be monogamous when he's not, this can have consequences for Jane's well-being. Or take an example where Jane decides that she only wants to engage in sexual relationships with men who she believes would make good parenting partners in case of pregnancy results. She believes men who are emotionally invested are more likely to make good parenting partners, so she has a policy of only having sex with men who are genuinely emotionally invested. Interfering with Jane's ability to have control over this aspect of her sexual life may have consequences that are inconsistent with her goals. Moreover, autonomy and self-determination are widely considered to be basic human rights and essential components of living a fully human life. Some have called this capacity for self-determination and free choice the source of value that humans have. Kant refers to this value as dignity. Whether or not this is accurate, respecting the humanity of others requires that we respect people's autonomy as it's one of our central capacities. To interfere with a person's autonomy is to treat them as less than fully human, as a thing rather than as a person. Alan Wertheimer has called this form of harm a dignitary injury. It's an objective harm rather than a subjective harm, insofar as it need not be something that the subject is even aware of having happened in order for their humanity to have been denied and for them to have been violated. Finally, undermining a person's sexual autonomy results in experiential harms. Experiential harms are harms that have a subjective component where negative feelings or psychological states are produced. In contexts of forcible rape, where the violation to autonomy is something that someone is aware of in the moment, much of the experiential harm involves immediate or synchronic distress. But when autonomy is undermined through deception, the subject is generally not aware of the violation until well after the event. But this doesn't mean that it doesn't cause comparable diachronic emotional or psychological distress. Non-consensual sex is experienced as traumatic and as a special kind of violation. Few women who are violated would classify rape as essentially equivalent to having been hit. I just want to make clear that although I use the example of women's experience here, I don't mean it to only be something that applies to women. Okay, moreover, having one's body penetrated is worse than having the violation stop at the body's surface. Since the body is experienced as the locus of oneself, the feeling that one was not in control over the boundary may feel like a sense of invasion or being occupied from within or having oneself overcome or taken over. It's reported that the risk of developing PTSD is higher for victims of rape than any other traumatic event except being held captive, tortured, and kidnapped. Rape victims report more suicidal thoughts, suicidal attempts, than victims of other crimes. These statistics concern forcible rape, but it stands to reason that anyone who believes that their sexual autonomy was violated or undermined and who feels that they did not consent would be vulnerable to effects like these. Rights violations also cause second-order distress. This is distress that derives from the belief that someone has violated one's rights and shown a disregard for you as a person. It is, as some anonymous person has described, an experience like having reflected back to you in the way that you are treated, the way that you appear to the perpetrator as a non-person. Moreover, in the case where the perpetrator is known and trusted, there are additional experiential effects. People who express consent, whether it is valid or not, often see themselves as having chosen to engage in the activity. This often leads them to feel particularly culpable or partially culpable and results in undue guilt or shame. In addition, any cultural message excusing the kind of behavior, such as the idea that boys will be boys, puts the responsibility in the hands of the victim to fact check and assure that her partner is trustworthy. And this may lead to the feelings that reflect a disposition to second guess or call into question our own behavior and judgment and sense of trust. The fact that we trusted the individual can lead to feelings of betrayal at finding out that one's autonomy was undermined. And finally, depending on what the lie is about in particular, there may be related experiential harms. If Ed lied to Jane about the nature of his intentions or the depth of his affections, the result in the loss of a relationship that Jane believed would be long-term may add an additional layer of distress. So I've discussed the nature of consent and its connection to autonomy. Interfering with a person's sexual autonomy is a way of causing harm, and so therefore it's morally impermissible. It follows that if and when deception interferes with a sexual partner's ability to give autonomous consent, we ought not to lie. Now I want to look at the two conditions that I think are part of what comes to most people's minds when they think of paradigmatic cases where someone is morally culpable for undermining their sexual partner's consent. These may both be features of what count as prosecutable rape by fraud. the intention condition, and the counterfactual condition. I'm going to explain why I do not think that either of these two features is necessary in order for a person to have interfered with consent in a way that makes them morally culpable. So the intention condition states that we're culpable for deceptions that interfere with consent when we lie with the intent to get consent. But if we assume that we owe it to one another to not cause unnecessary harm, and it can be shown that interfering with someone's sexual autonomy harms them, then it follows simply from this that if deception interferes with sexual autonomy, then we ought not to deceive our sexual partners, regardless of whether or not our intention was to produce the harm. There is reason, and I'll show it, to think that deception does interfere with sexual autonomy, but that'll come in a bit. So the other common misconception is that some deception interferes with consent only when it concerns some fact such that had the person known the truth about it, they would not have consented. And this covers two types of cases. First, it covers cases where a person lies about some fact that had the subject known that was false, she would not have consented. So for example, Ed tells Jane that he loves her, but in fact he does not. In the second kind of case, a person lies and says something is true that is not true. So for example, Ed says he does not, or something that is not true. The person lies and says that something is not true that is true. So, for example, Ed says he does not have a sexually transmitted disease, but he does, and had Jane known, she would not have consented. So I don't think that this counterfactual condition is necessary for deception to violate someone's sexual autonomy either. If consent is only undermined if someone lies about some fact that had the person known the truth about it, this would have made a difference to whether or not they would have consented, then it seems that we don't commit a wrong if we lie about something that is irrelevant to whether our partner would have consented. But this will yield unintuitive moral verdicts. Imagine a case where both Ed and Jane are HIV positive, but both are unaware of the other's HIV status. Since neither risks infection, if they were to have sex with one another, we can assume that it wouldn't make a difference to either's issuance of consent to know about their partner's HIV status. So the counterfactual view of consent permits that they lie to one another about their HIV status. But wouldn't we want to say that any view about moral rightness that permits one to lie about their HIV status to a sexual partner is wrong? We might be able to accommodate cases like this by using a reasonable person standard about the expected harm of deception. Many people who are not HIV positive would consider the HIV status of their sexual partner to be relevant to their consent. In the absence of information that contradicts this, we might take it that a person should consider the expected harms using a reasonable person standard to determine whether or not they're permitted to lie. But this is still going to be problematic. It is true that there may be some obvious types of information that we can identify which will be relevant to most people, including their STD status. But if we respect the autonomy of our partners, this demands that we acknowledge that each individual will also have his or her own preferences, desires, and even idiosyncrasies. Things that they decide suddenly on the spur of the moment are relevant to them. To deny that a person has a right to make whatever features they want relevant to consent is to reject the notion of sexual autonomy. Therefore, we can't appeal to a reasonable person standard here. We can't even come to know, in fact, about what facts are relevant to consent in our partner, because the psychological evidence points to the fact that we're often unaware of a good portion of our own preferences. We're highly fallible when it comes to what things we take to be genuine deal breakers in our own cases. We often tolerate things that we didn't think we would have tolerated once we come to know about them. We aren't aware of our dislike of certain things until we're made aware of them in the moment. And we are sometimes surprised to find out that some things matter to us that we would not have expected would. In short, it's both true that our own preferences are fickle and we have ideas about ourselves that aren't true. I think that I've provided some good reasons to doubt that for a particular lie that we tell to our sexual partner to be wrong, it must satisfy the intention condition and the counterfactual condition. Next, I'm going to look more closely at the notion of sexual consent. I want to describe the view of consent that I find more natural. I will then say something about what moral obligations with respect to honesty I think follow naturally from this view of consent. We normally understand consenting as an act of expressing or granting permission to another person, and this is an important component. We don't have permission to gain sexual access to a person who has a genuine desire to participate in a sexual encounter, but who is unable to express the desire. But while expressing permission is a necessary part of valid consent, it is not on its own sufficient. A verbal act of consent must express a genuine desire to participate in a sexual activity in order to be an expression of autonomy. By a genuine desire, I mean a desire that is fully voluntary and authentically issues from the person, rather than a desire that is based on pressure or coercion. For example, consider a case where a woman is told by her husband that if she doesn't go out and prostitute herself, that she will be killed. She desires her life, so she may choose prostitution, but this choice did not issue from her own authentic desire. In order to better understand the process of consent, we need to say more about the psychological state. I propose that the psychological state of willingness that is expressed when we express consent is what we call an intentional state. An intentional state is one in which we adopt some kind of perspective on an object by taking a psychological attitude toward it. We conceive of it in a particular way. For example, you can desire an apple, you can fear an apple. Desire and fear are psychological attitudes that you take toward the object, which is the apple. Or you can be willing to participate in a particular situation. The alternative view would be that willingness is just a general feeling, a willingness to engage in nothing in particular. This doesn't seem right, though. When we consent to a sexual relationship, we consent to something in particular. If we were to be given instead a knife fight, we would not feel that this was something that we had been willing to do. How do we best characterize the way in which the psychological state relates us to the object or the thing that it is a willingness for? One possibility is that we become directly related to the situation to which we consent, the actual act with its actual properties. The other possibility is that the relation involves thinking about a representation of the situation that presents it to us as how we understand it to be, or under some description of it. On this view, ideally, that idea about the situation that we have matches with the situation that we're to engage in. Here are some general considerations that I think favor this latter view. The philosopher Gottlieb Frege noted that two people can think about the same object or thing in the world, or refer to it with language, despite the fact that their thoughts characterize the thing differently according to how they each understand the object under different modes of presentation. Let's say that Jane and Joan both know Ed, who has been trying to engage both of them in a sexual relationship. But Ed reveals different sides of himself to Jane than he reveals to Joan. Jane knows Ed to be confident and egotistical. Joan knows Ed to be insecure and have a weak sense of self. When they each think about Ed, their thoughts are about one and the same person, but they have different concepts or understandings of Ed. Their ideas of Ed describe Ed differently. I think that the best way to understand the intentional state of willingness is in this latter way. When we consent to a situation, we consent to a particular situation. We consent to have a sexual relationship with a particular person, and the way that we understand the particular person includes more than their numerical identity. Part of the causal basis for our consenting includes information that we know about them. that they meet certain criteria of ours, that they don't have particular qualities that for us would be deal breakers. I would maintain that it is very likely that the intentional state includes quite a bit of information, some of it causally and counterfactually relevant to our consent, and some of it not. And it doesn't just have to be about the person. It could be about the situation, various things having to do with the context. So in the case where a sexual partner lies to us, the false information that they tell us may well be included in how our intentional state of willingness describes the situation that we are willing to take part in. When we express willingness, it is this situation as described that we are willing to engage in. And when we express consent, this is what our consent is consent to. So in cases like where Ed lies about his identity, it seems right to say that what Jane takes herself to be consenting to is not what the situation in the world is actually like, or that the world fails to match the description or understanding of how Jane takes it to be. In this case, what Jane ends up getting is not what she consented to, and Ed is responsible for this being so. I think that now that we have a clearer understanding of how consent works, we can start to sketch an ethical view about our moral obligations to be honest that are based on it. When we consent, we express our agreement to take part in a specific activity that we understand under some description. Deception is a problem, at least because it interferes with the person's ability to consent to the situation that's in front of them. The false information that's given can make its way into the information that characterizes what we are consenting to. And to this extent, it makes it such that we consent to a situation that is other than the actual situation that we are misled to take part in. It doesn't matter whether Jane would have had sex with Ed's brother Stan if she had known that the person in front of her was Stan and not Ed, because in this particular case, Jane consented to have sex with Ed, and Stan is morally culpable for this failure of consent when he is responsible for preventing Jane from being able to consent to the actual situation. Did you understand that example, how that worked? So, yeah, just assume that Stan and Ed are twin brothers, and Jane is married to Ed, but she likes Stan too. And Stan decides that he will pretend to be Ed one evening and approach Jane, and she consents to have sex with him, thinking that it's Ed. But she would have consented had she known it was Stan. But what she consented to was having sex with Ed, okay? So it doesn't matter on this view that I've been building that she would have had sex with Stan had she known. On the counterfactual view, well, it doesn't matter. You know, what matters is what she consented to, which is sex with Ed, and that's not what she got. And so she did not consent to that relationship, even if she would have consented had she known. What matters is whether what she consented to matches with the way that the world actually is. And because Stan is the person who made it such that she could not consent to the actual situation, by lying to her, Stan is culpable for undermining her consent. So this story about our moral obligation to honesty is still incomplete. For one thing, it seems an open possibility that there could be exceptions. One might say that many cases of deception could be justified. One might argue that we engage in justified deception to a sexual partner when we deceive someone out of a right that we have. For example, the right to free speech, or the right to privacy about certain matters, like maybe your STD status, or even that a right to pursue one's own aim or positive sexual autonomy justifies someone in obtaining the sexual partner that they desire through deceptive means. Or imagine a case where Ed is a spy who must lie about his identity in order to preserve his life. Could Ed's right to life justify his deceiving Jane about his identity in order to have sex with her? None of these potentially conflicting rights or goods need come into conflict with the obligation that Ed has to not undermine his partner's sexual autonomy, if it turns out that those lies would interfere with consent. Undermining Jane's sexual autonomy is not an inevitable result of Ed's deception, because having sex with Jane is not necessary or inevitable. Only in engaging in a sexual act with Jane does Ed actually undermine her sexual autonomy. So Ed can exercise his right to privacy, his right to safety, his right to free speech, without interfering with Jane's autonomy and causing her harm, just by not having sex with her after he does it. Another concern is that it looks like the only way that deception interferes with consent is, on this view so far, is by corrupting the intentional state of what we are willing to engage in, and thereby undermining it. But it isn't clear that all of the information that we provide a sexual partner makes it into the intentional state, and it isn't clear that all of the information in the intentional state, that's the state of willingness to engage in, that describes the situation that you think you're going to be engaging in a certain kind of way, the way that you understand it to be, including various variable facts about the person that you think that you're going to be having sex with. So it isn't clear that all of the information that we provide to a sexual partner makes it into the intentional state of willingness, and it isn't clear that all of the information in the intentional state is equally or in the same way relevant to consent, such that getting it wrong yields a failure of consent. I'm not interested here in dealing with the specifics of what information in particular is important and what is not. That's going to be relative to particular cases. In fact, I don't think that we can really answer these questions at all. But in the final part of this paper, I'm going to fill in the picture of consent that I've already discussed and then explain the moral imperatives for honesty that follows. So based on the discussion up until this point, it may seem that deception is problematic for consent because information that we deceive someone with respect to can become part of the description by which we characterize what we're consenting to, and in those cases it undermines our consent. But this oversimplifies things. It rests on two mistaken assumptions. The first is that the only facts that are important to our ability to consent are those facts that are part of the way our psychological state of willingness characterizes the situation that we're consenting to. The second mistake is that all information that is relevant to consent is relevant in the same way and to the same degree. In fact, even if there is information about a person or situation that does not make it into the content or characterization of what we're willing to engage in, that information likely plays an important role in what information did make it into that characterization. Moreover, I think that even false information that does not undermine or nullify consent can interfere with a person's sexual autonomy and weaken consent or make it less robust. I'm going to say some brief things about these two points that I just made. Now, so first, I'll say some things about the first point. My own view is that the intentional state that characterizes what we are consenting to is probably pretty rich insofar as it likely includes a good deal of information about the situation. For instance, our understanding of who our sexual partner is, depending, of course, on how familiar he or she is to you, is often quite complex. And I think we bring this understanding of them to bear whenever we refer to them in our thoughts. Moreover, I think the state of willingness certainly includes more than is counterfactually relevant to consent. It may not matter that Ed's arm is broken, for example, but his broken arm may still be a part of Jane's understanding of Ed in the very moment. Another possibility is that the state just includes things that are causally relevant to someone's giving consent. So the things that caused Jane to be willing to consent to Ed. But this can't be right. The fact that Ed is a poor dancer may be a significant and essential part of how Jane understands Ed, but it is not a part of the causal basis for her consenting. It is not one of the reasons why she did. So some of the answer to what is included in the content or the information that's part of how we characterize the situation that we're consenting to will depend on personal psychology of the people involved, maybe even cognitive aptitude. So the way that we understand the situation we are consenting to often includes information about it that we have collected ourselves, such as things that we've seen or experienced. And it often includes what one has been directly told by their partner. But much of the information, for example, any information about the type of person that one takes one's partner to be, will be the result of a person's own reasoning. Jane witnesses Ed engage in various behaviors, and Ed conveys information about himself directly through testimony. He tells Jane what he had for lunch, the name of his first pet, the meaning of his tattoo, and about how many sexual partners he has had. Based on these things, Jane makes inferences about Ed's character. Information that Ed has given Jane can form the basis for these inferences, or it can help to determine what other information might be attended to or relevant to Jane. It could also help to determine the weight or importance of factors in inferences that Jane goes on to make. If Jane wants to make a determination about Ed's character and she has information that as a child he abused puppies, then whether Ed tells Jane that the symbol on his tattoo means unity or heartless will make a difference to how the other information that she has about him is weighted. If it means heartless, then the fact that he abused puppies as a child is highly relevant. If it means unity, then his childhood behavior might be better explained by a lack of understanding of animal suffering. I think that it's pretty likely that when it comes to concerns like how to understand someone's character, all of the information that we get about them is potentially relevant. For instance, new facts that we learn all the time will be, at the very least, processed in terms of whether or not they are consistent with how we already take the person to be, or inconsistent. They will be seen as either confirming or contradicting the picture that we already have of who our partner is. So it seems that any, or maybe all, information that we tell to a sexual partner is likely to be relevant to consent to a greater or lesser degree. Even if some lie does not present a defeater to consent or wholly undermine it, there are a number of other ways in which it may potentially interfere with our ability to consent to a situation as it is. In many of these cases, it may weaken consent. Initially, it may seem that we can draw a line between deceptions that undermine a person's consent and those that just interfere with or weaken consent at the distinction between the information that is part of the way we characterize what we are consenting to, and then all of the other supporting information that we use to make inferences that might be relevant to the information that is part of how we characterize what we're consenting to. But I don't think this is going to work. I don't see why all of the ways that we are characterizing the situation or the properties that we are taking to be present are relevant in the same way or to the same degree in whether we get it right or whether consent is valid. If Jane sees Ed to be wearing a specific kind of shoe, and it turns out that he isn't, would we want to say that she didn't consent, even if the information about the shoe were part of her understanding of who he is in the moment and what she's consenting to? I think in most cases this would seem counterintuitive. But it can still weaken her consent if Ed lies about this fact. And morality dictates that Ed respect Jane's autonomy, and that means that he acknowledged that the information could play any of these roles. And maybe it is, but maybe it would undermine her consent in the moment. Maybe at that moment she just spontaneously decides that this is really, really important. So likewise, I think that just because some piece of information doesn't make it into our description of what we're consenting to, this doesn't disqualify it from being essential enough to that state that, and consent, that deceiving someone about it wouldn't qualify as having undermined their consent. Let's say that Ed lies to Jane about the meaning of his tattoo, and he says that the tattoo signifies unity when in fact it signifies heartless. Based on this and some other pro-social behavior that Ed engages in, Jane has good reason to infer that Ed is a decent, caring human being. And this, but not the meaning of his tattoo, is part of how her state of willingness characterizes the situation that she's consenting to. It still seems in this case that Ed's deception might have undermined Jane's consent, though I take it that this will be contestable. But there is still reason to think that the issue of what information counts as a defeater for consent is orthogonal to the issue of what information is present in the description of the intentional state of what we are willing to participate in and what is not. So I started out with the question, I'm concluding now. What is the relationship between deception and consent? And what, if any, moral obligations follow? Consent is an expression of autonomy, and violating or interfering with someone's sexual autonomy harms them in at least one of three ways, potentially in all three. So undermining or interfering with consent is a harm. I hope to have given some reasons to think that deceiving sexual partners about matters both great and small creates problems for consent. I've sketched an understanding of consent that I think accurately reflects the mechanics and significance of it. On that understanding, I've shown how deception can undermine consent or make it invalid, and how, even when not nullifying one's partner's consent, deception can still interfere or weaken it. I take it as a basic assumption that it's important when we engage in sexual relationships, regardless of whether they be brief and fleeting or committed in long term, that they be robustly consensual. We therefore ought not to lie to our sexual partners, and it makes no difference to this moral imperative what the deception is about or whether we have rights that conflict with these obligations.
I will open the floor for questions, and I'll recognize question one at a time, please. Get to the question. Would be our ground rule. I remember one ground rule. Second ground rule is be kind.
You spoke mainly about active deception, but what seems more complicated is a failure to disclose.
Yeah.
And I was wondering about your comments there and where you would draw the line on it, even if it is. I think in a situation where a person has an STD and the issue just never came up, and especially if unprotected sex were coming up, I think most people would say there's an obligation to disclose that.
Yeah.
But then you can get to harder issues. For example, if a woman briefly was a prostitute 20 years ago, is there a need to disclose that? Or was raped 20 years ago, that might make a difference for somebody, should that be disclosed? Or as a 5-year-old child did something, tortured a puppy or something, like the issue you raised. And I'm just wondering if you get the same, if they've got the same issue there, or, and if so, where you really would draw the line on that?
Yeah. So there's even a more complicated case like self-deception, and how that factors into things. So, but just taking cases where you know a certain fact about yourself, I haven't thought too deeply about it, but I do believe that there's such a thing as a lie by omission. If it would be reasonable to expect a person to reveal information in a certain context and they don't, then I think that counts as a deception. And so, for example, there are going to be, I think, some things that just generally count as lies by omission, whether or not you even had a conversation with the other person, because most people do consider that information to be relevant. And in our culture, it's understood that these are things that, that people ought to reveal, whether or not you're married, you know, if you meet somebody, whether you have a disease that's contagious that someone could contract. And then there are, you know, how many sexual partners you had. You don't have to reveal that to a person. If they ask you, that's another story, though, because then, you know, it's not an issue of whether or not you're just keeping something from them that they didn't ask for. Now you have to, now you'd be lying if you didn't reveal that information. And I do think that people have an obligation in that case to reveal the information. In the case of rape, it's a little, I'm not really sure what to say about that. You know, one would think that people would know better than to ask a question like that. So, and on the other hand, if it comes, you know, if the question is how many sexual partners have you had, I'm not really sure that that's considered to be relevant to that question. You know, so because that you could consider that an act of violence and not a sexual encounter that you engaged in. But other things are going to be more complicated. You know, did you abuse animals as a child? I'm not really sure like how. I would think that we have an obligation to reveal that if someone asks, but you could then say, well, that was actually not me. I mean, that, I'm so far removed from that person that did that at that time. You know, it changed so much that, but I don't know, that's how I would answer that question now. But I do believe that there are lies by omission. And, yeah.
So I was reminded of the original Star Wars movie where Han Solo consents to transporting Luke and Obi-Wan, and eventually they get surrounded by Darth Vader and the stormtroopers. And Han says, I never bargained for this, which seems like it, your idea of consenting to a description of a situation. The situation he ended up in didn't match the description that he consented to. So you have the Han Solo theory of sexual consent. but I was a bit worried that maybe it just didn't give the right answers in some cases. So imagine that J.K. Rowling, before she's published her first Harry Potter book, she really wants to publish it, and her friend points out Stanley is kind of a repulsive creature across the room and tells J.K. that he's this editor for this major press, and so she wants to get the Harry Potter book published, so she consents to sleep with Stanley. In fact, he's not the editor. He never misled her in any way, but still, it seems like you know, her Han Solo, you know, the situation she thought she was bargaining for was sleeping with the editor that can get her book published, and when she finds out eventually, she, you know, as far as the counterfactual theory is concerned, she's saying, I never would have consented if I'd known he wasn't an editor. And it sounds like, on your view, you would say she didn't consent, because what she consented to was the situation under a description, and the speed of the description, that he was an editor for this press, that wasn't in fact the case, so she didn't consent to the relationship they ended up having. But it sounds weird to me for her to complain afterward and say this is some sort of rape or non-consensual sex.
Well, I wouldn't say it was rape. I would say it was that there was, you know, possibly you don't want to call it fully a non-consensual sex, but that consent was not robust in that case. It's not the fault of the person that she had sex with. And so her expression of consent still removes that boundary for him. It's still morally transformative in that sense that he, you know, he has that right, but it's not, but she did not consent to what she ended up getting. And I would say that the person who told her is culpable for that. Is he culpable for rape? No, but something that interfered, that made it such that she ended up doing something that she didn't consent to, then yes, I would say.
If they were inclined to say she consented to
it. Well, you could, there are some, on some views of consent, consent is just the expression of permission, and it doesn't involve the psychological state at all, that's something else. On other views, it's just the psychological state, and the expression is not the consent. Consenting is a subjective state. On my view, consenting involves both of these components, because you can't, you know, if I'm in that psychological state, but I don't, consent has to be something that is morally transformative in the sense that it allows someone to do something. So if I'm just in the psychological state, but I can't express it to anyone, it doesn't have that kind of power. But at the same time, it can't just be the expression without the psychological state, because if I am forced by someone else to go out and solicit sex from someone, and I express consent to them, but I'm not in a state of genuine desire, I wouldn't want to say that I fully consented in that case. I was forced. But the person that I expressed consent to isn't culpable if he didn't know that I was forced. You know what I mean? But the person who forced me is.
Well, what about a situation of, like, marriage, where you have a couple, and maybe, you know, the husband, the wife is not interested, the husband's interested, and the wife does it because she cares about the husband, not because she's in the mood. So she's not doing it because she's in that state you talked about, but for another reason. So what is your view on that?
I think that's fine. Yeah. I mean, she's still willing. She's still willing to do it. She's not, she doesn't desire it in the sense that we normally think of sexual desire, but she's still willing. You
but
know?
In the extreme example you gave in terms of her being killed or whatever, like, that's this... She's not doing it for actual... She doesn't want to do it either. You know what I mean?
That's a little bit...
I mean, she does want to do it. She does want to do it, but she's not doing it for an intrinsic reason.
Right. I would say that she doesn't really want to do it. It's not an authentic desire.
Well, the wife doesn't want to do it either.
It's an authentic desire, though. It's something that she's decided she wants to do. If you're given a choice between your life and doing this other thing, then you're choosing to do that other thing. I don't think it's an authentic desire. It's just preserving your life.
Yeah, it's coercion.
Oh, I was just a follow-up. My bad.
Oh, let me break that. We'll go to Rob. My apologies. Bob, did you have a question?
Okay.
Then we'll go to you next.
I was just curious what you thought the role of alcohol plays in this. So if you have a man and a woman, they meet at a bar, and they both become inebriated and they have sex, and neither one would have had sex if they had been drinking. In that scenario, do you think there is deception and lack of sexual autonomy on both sides?
So I don't think that there's deception involved there, but, you know, whether or not, a lot of people think that under, and I think legally too, under state, there's a certain point of inebriation when you consider consent cannot be given beyond that point. And I haven't seen this because it was in the men's room and I wasn't in the men's room, but I was with someone in a bar who went into the men's room and saw a big poster on the wall about consent and what kinds of things undermine consent and how do you know when someone is fully consented to it. And so there's some, you know, out in the public, some awareness that alcohol can play a role in this way. Now, it's possible, I mean, if you're married and you both drink, do you know, are you going to... And you're just like, you drink way too much and then you end up having sex. Is that non-consensual? Well, there was some standing state of, like, agreement. And, of course, you have to agree each time. But in that case, you know, I wouldn't want to say that it was under... That particular event was undermined by the alcohol. But, yeah, so alcohol can do that. Now, there might be a case where two people, they drink way too much... They wouldn't have had sex had they not been drinking, but they did, and they both regret it the next day. And there's a sense in which neither of them was in a state where they could consent. But they don't, and they feel guilty about, oh, I shouldn't have done that, you know, they feel bad about it, but they don't hold the other person responsible. So in that case, I would say that the subjective harm isn't robust, you know, they don't feel violated, they feel maybe more like they had done something wrong. I mean, you need not feel violated for your consent to have been undermined. But, and I'm not sure how alcohol influences the culpability of a person either. I think a person can still be culpable even if they've been drinking a lot. But, so maybe they are both morally culpable for dignitary harms, but they don't feel, they're not going to prosecute one another because they don't blame each other for it. You know what I mean? So.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Just a quick question. how do you apply this concept if you're, say, from a different gender perspective? The way you define consent, I think, is with reference to sexual intercourse, consent by the woman. And, of course, I think the way you define rape, penetration, that makes it good. Normally, at least with women, there would be no rape for a man. Was, do you think there's any protected interest in terms of sex, say, by a man, in terms of deception or something like that?
Yeah, I think this applies equally to men and women. And that the definition of rape that I gave is the FBI's definition. So on that definition, men can be raped, but not by women. And I just think that the whole notion of what counts as sex that's assumed there is wrong, because it seems to assume that penetration is required for sex to, like, I don't know. But I do think that a woman could rape a man. And I do think that deception could undermine consent. But I have read that men are less likely to report feeling violated when they find out that they were deceived into having sex. And so that maybe shows that there's less likely to be a subjective harm produced. But it doesn't mean that there can't be, and that they're not equally valid if they are. And but more importantly, there are still dignitary harms that are done in cases like that. You've still violated someone's autonomy. They still had a right to keep that barrier in place and to set the conditions for being removed. And no one has a right to take that power from anybody, male and female. So.
Thank you.
You're up.
I'm treating this microphone properly, I guess. There's certainly an aura of unreality about this kind of dialogue, because it is so removed from the absence of recognized constraints, except in extreme cases, in this area of sexual behavior, particularly given the fluidity that sexual mores have displayed over the last several decades, lots of decades in my case. The analogies that come to my mind that underline the relative unreality of this is more like in a case of business law, there would be failures of due diligence, failures of disclosure that were pretty minor, given that standards were relatively fluid. There is an expectation of diligence on the buyer beware. And in this particular regime, this can run all the way from minor qualms all the way to very serious offenses. And so there's a sort of unreality about imagining these things in those terms, because I don't think people are prepared to negotiate things that explicitly. And if they are now getting prepared to negotiate things that explicitly, I think it's on the one hand very good, and on the other hand sort of kind of unfortunate that they have to be negotiated that explicitly.
Is there a question? Nope, just a comment.
He does have a question. I'll try to put a question here. You talked about cases where there's a one person deceiving another, and another case where we have two people not deceiving each other but being foolish or whatever else, ignorant of their choices. But what if you've got a case, say, a man's in a bar talking to somebody, not the woman. He, you know, mentions he's a millionaire. Well, he's not. She overhears it, approaches him, asks him about the issue, says, does it matter? She says no. They both lie. they're both, she's obviously interested, he's a millionaire, he's obviously lying to her that he is, without the intent of initially deceiving her when he says it, but he doesn't correct the issue. Mm-hmm. They then sleep together, they've deceived each other. Is there any one, either one of them more at fault than the other? Are they both equally at fault? And is there, what are your thoughts on such an issue?
I missed one part of that. So he was overheard lying to someone else, and then he doesn't deny it when it becomes apparent that she thinks that
that's raises true. The issue. Yeah. He doesn't deny that he's not, or doesn't own up to the fact that he's not a millionaire, but asks her, does it matter to you?
Yeah.
And she says, oh, no, it's not relevant at all. And so she's lying to him in order to have sex with him, presumably get money out of him at some point in time. And he's lying to her in order to get sex. They're both lying to each other. Is he any more culpable, less culpable, or are they equally? Do they deserve each other? Do they both get what they deserve?
I don't know. I don't know how. I would have to know about the specifics of their psychology in order to be able to say how culpable and contrast them with one another, to see how much of a role that played in what aspect of the consenting process or the psychological state of willingness to answer it that way. But they're both wrong for lying, and they're both culpable for at least interfering with the other person's ability to give robust consent. So, and the fact that he doesn't deny it when she brings it up, that's just as much of a lie as like saying that it's, you know, because it was brought up. There are other cases where I can imagine that, you know, say you bring up that you're a millionaire, and it seems natural that the other person would say, oh, I'm a millionaire too, unless there was some reason why it would be dangerous for them to do that. And so that might count as a lie too, but in this case it seems, you know, it's even, he doesn't deny it when she asks, so it's definitely.
So if I'm understanding the conclusion of your speech is lying is wrong.
And there are a lot of reasons. You know, it interferes with the ability to have good relationships, and good relationships are valuable. There are a number of reasons, but I'm dealing specifically with why it's wrong in virtue of people's ability to consent. So even if it turns out to be the case in 100 years, philosophers discover that lying is perfectly fine. You know, it doesn't have any negative consequence or cause any other kind of harm. It does interfere with people's ability to consent. So that's one of its wrong-making properties.
Okay, we have time for one more. One last question.
I'll ask a question.
Okay, great.
My concern is, I don't think we should talk about enough, specifically young males on college campuses where the girl gives consent at the time and then thinks better of it the next day and thinks, well, maybe I shouldn't have given consent, or maybe I didn't explicitly give consent in a way that I think was 100%. So it's sort of this ex post facto retraction. And then she comes back on the mail and says, I never gave you consent, or I didn't mean to give you consent. Then here's the male in this very, very difficult position where he thought that he did get consent, but now she's saying that he did.
Yeah.
Yeah, what about that?
In the moment, she did give consent. So, you know.
Work against work.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I don't know, you know, in that.
And he's going to
how. It's wrong of her to lie, you know. On the other hand, there is an issue that, you know, sometimes people don't explicitly give consent, and what they're thinking is that I'm not sure that I want to do this, but there is pressure to do it, and the other person is kind of pressuring them, and so they kind of go along with it, but there was no explicit consent given, and they actually didn't really fully desire to do it. And so in those kinds of cases, the next day, it seems that she's more within her rights to feel like this, she did not actually consent or want to do that. And then to say, hey, wait, you know, I felt pressured. I was pressured into doing that. I said no, or I'm not sure, or this or that, and you kept saying, oh, come on, and, you know, so in cases like, and that's why I think on college campuses there's now a push to the yes means yes campaign, and that's when you're going to engage in sex with somebody, make sure that you have consent and that you have unambiguous consent. So, I mean, it may seem to kind of detract from, like, in the moment, you know, but each step as it progresses, people are encouraged to seek another expression of consent, that the person really wants it to go to this next level, so that there is no ambiguity on either people's parts about whether or not they both want to be doing what's going on. So.
Let's give another round of applause for our speaker.